Radio Wasteland comes to you from the Reading studios of Free Fire Radio, 96.5 FM and AM 1460.
All right, you are listening to Radio Wasteland, and for our last show of the year, we thought it'd be fun to revisit some of our favorite segments of interviews from this past year. First up here, we have a great interview with Joseph Laycock as he talks about Dungeons & Dragons and the moral panic behind Satanism.
All right, welcome back to Radio Wasteland and our guest, Joseph Laycock. How do we think this panic about Dungeons & Dragons even came about? Because it seemed like D&D, we're going to use D&D as an example. There were tons of role-playing games. There's been tons since. But, you know, it seems like all of that was flowing so much under the radar. How did it come to such heavy attention?
Well, I think there's two ways you can look at it. I mean, on one hand, this may have been inevitable. So this was what in sociology is called a moral panic, right? This is like the Red Scare or the Salem witch trials or any number of things where the community, you know, decides that something is a threat to our very existence and we have to sort of rally against it. And in the literature on moral panics, it says what you need to have a really good moral panic is you need one, some innocent who is under attack. And then you need an enemy who isn't strong enough to actually fight back. So D&D is perfect. You've got these innocent children being seduced, and you've got, you know, a shoestring budget role-playing game company. Nobody can really challenge your claims if you want to say this is a satanic game.
Right.
From the other side of things, there were some historical moments that kind of kicked this all off. Dungeons & Dragons was published in 1974, and in 1979, you had this famous case of Dallas Eggers, who disappeared from Michigan State University. And he was from a wealthy family who hired a detective named William Deere, who gave a press release and said, "I think I know why this child disappeared. He played too much Dungeons and Dragons, and he entered a fugue state and is currently wandering around believing that he lives in a medieval world." None of that was true. The kid called his family from New Orleans a few weeks later and said, "I'm ready to come home." But by then the story was in the press. And so that was sort of the beginning of this idea that this was more than a game, that it had profound, dangerous psychological consequences to it.
A-plus detective work.
Yeah, totally. Way to phone
I'd that. Like a job where I can just make stuff up.
Yeah.
Well, actually, other than this.
Yeah, well, let's talk about satanic panic for a little bit. It's like how much I've been under the impression that there's never actually been a proven satanic killing ever.
That's pretty much true. I mean, it depends on what you count as satanic. You have figures like Richard Ramirez, right, who certainly killed people and said that he was a Satanist. You have an incident in Matamoros, Mexico in 1988 where a spring breaker was killed by a drug cartel. But there really is nothing like this sort of organized criminal a satanic group that kills for the sake of religion. It's almost always, if there's anything at all, it's a drug cartel or it's some sort of other criminal organization. So, yeah, this is mostly something that existed in the public's imagination, and it still does with things like Pizzagate, right? Pizzagate was very much a part of this satanic conspiracy theories.
Yeah, but I've always been just surprised that how this satanic panic really just took over everything. It's like, I guess we were at the beginnings of the moral right and the sort of influence of church into the Republican Party, and then we had Reagan coming in, and you know, because prior to that the Republican Party wasn't quite the party of religion that it maybe evolved into, and so was it just churches fueling the fear to get parents and flocks to watch their children? Or I just don't really understand how it took over so heavily.
Well, we still don't fully understand it. It needs to be studied more. But a couple of things. So in the 1970s, when people said they were scared of cults, they meant actual religious groups that really existed. They meant the Hare Krishnas and the Unification Church, also called the Moonies, and this kind of Christian sex group called the Children of God. And this is partly because in 1965, immigration laws changed, and suddenly there were a lot more Asians in America, and some of them were missionizing for their religion. And so in the 70s, there was real fear of mind control and that cults could brainwash you and things, and that colored the reception of Dungeons and Dragons, especially terms like Dungeon Master, right, really scared people. By the 80s, it was pretty clear that the Hare Krishnas were not going to take over America. Right? That was no longer a threat. But the fear changed from being afraid of groups that really exist to groups that actually only exist in the imagination. And it's not really clear why this happened exactly when it did. David Bromley is a sociologist, and he thinks that one factor was this was the beginning of economic changes where households were switching from being one income to two income. And what that means is that you need to have other people taking care of your kids, right? You need to have send them to piano lessons and soccer practice, and you have to pay for daycare, and they have to ride the school bus. And one weird aspect of the Satanic Panic was a lot of the suspicion was placed on people who ran daycare centers, right? This fear that while you're at work, the daycare provider is torturing your children in satanic rituals. And so what David Bromley kind of hypothesized is that even though there aren't really Satanists controlling your children, it felt like there were, right? These families were really reluctant to turn their kids over to all these other people, but they had to for economic reasons. And so the idea of satanic cults are coming for our kids, it sort of began in the mind almost as a kind of metaphor. And then what was sort of a metaphorical way of talking about a changing social structure became literally true. And suddenly people were really claiming that those daycare providers are agents of Satan and are torturing children.
Yeah, I always thought it was weird because, like, at the time, I remember, you know, my mom was pretty forward-thinking. She was old enough to be my grandparents, so she was born in, like, 1936. And she never really seemed to have much of an issue with any of the role-playing games and stuff like that. But I would hear it, and we would talk about it, and then I'd find myself sitting in my group of friends and looking around at these people wondering how could anybody be scared of any of us.
You know? Oh, I know. I mean, this was really when I first realized as a child that the grown-ups don't know what they're talking about. Right? Yeah, so they act like they do, but how could anyone possibly think that this had something to do with danger or criminal activity? We're right here in the living room.
Right, yeah, and we're at home, and we're probably drinking obscene amounts of 2-liter sodas, but, you know, that's about it, you know.
Not doing Cheetos, yeah.
Right, you know. But to me, that was some of the greatest times of my life. Joe, we're coming up on break here. You're listening to Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Texas State University, Joseph Laycock, and we're talking about his book, Dangerous Games, What the Moral Panic Over Role-Playing Games Says About Play, Religion, and Imagined Worlds. You're listening to Radio Wasteland. Come on back. All right, welcome back to Radio Wasteland and our guest, Joseph Laycock. We're talking about his book, Dangerous Games, What the Moral Panic Over Role-Playing Games Says About Play, Religion, and Imagined Worlds. I have the thought during the commercial break that really what you were starting to say right towards the end of the last portion of our discussion was that a big part of the Satanic Panic and the connections to D&D had a tie-in. This was because of your saying the daycares had a tie-in with the sort of rise of stranger danger that was going on at the time.
Right. There was this idea that this was about corrupting children, right? That what the Satanists really wanted to do was to make our children into Satanists. And one of the ways that they could do this, along with heavy metal music and other things like that, was this game that sort of lures people in and gradually changes how they think and eventually makes you kill yourself or kill other people. And once that idea was out there, police began using D&D to explain all sorts of crimes that were clearly the result of, you know, crimes of passion or just stupidity. In an extreme case, there were two kids they found in a trailer who'd been playing Russian roulette, you know, with the revolver. It would seem to be a pretty open and shut case until the police found, you know, an 8-sided die or something in the trailer. And they said, aha, it's another D&D murder. So yeah, that was a factor, was this idea of we have to protect the children, right? This is about saving the kids from the machinations of the Satanists.
I do have to throw in that statistically, all the people who have killed themselves in the last year, and don't get me wrong, I feel terrible for that, but statistically, I bet you 90% of them have heard songs by Ariana Grande.
You're right, and this is highly alarming.
Highly alarming.
Hi, this is Linda Bott, and let me tell you about our North State Now show on Thursday nights at 6 p.m. right here on KCNR. The first Thursday of the month will be yours truly, covering arts and entertainment and all kinds of fun stuff. The second Thursday will be Michelle Slade, highlighting and interviewing North State heroes. The third Thursday is James Masada and Rhonda Alvey, bringing you all things with Enjoy the Magazine and Enjoy the Store. And the fourth Thursday from Shasta Regional Medical Center is Dr. Orna Gill covering all things women's health. The title sponsor for North State Now is the Reading Civic Auditorium, also brought to you by the Black Bear Diner, Shasta Regional Medical Center, and Carlene's Restaurant and Bar, located at 1100 Center Street. That's North State Now, right here on KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. 6 p.m. North State Now.
Get your car squeaky clean at Quick and Clean Car Wash in downtown Reading. Quick and Clean Car Wash on the corner of Market Street and Eureka Way next to Dutch Bros is open 7 days a week. Fast and convenient, you don't even have to get out of your vehicle. And they even towel dry your vehicle. They accept cash or card with no extra charge. Quick and Clean Car Wash, located at 1210 Market Street, downtown Reading. 530-243-4211.
Merry Christmas from Reading Electric Utility, your community-owned electric utility. On behalf of all RU employees, we are wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. Please remember, holiday safety starts with you. Never overload an extension cord or electrical circuit. Make sure extension cords and lights are rated for outdoor use. And remember, never to expose electrical outlets or connections to rain. Reading Electric Utility has been honored to serve you in 2019 and wishes you and your family a prosperous new year.
The McConnell Foundation wishes all active military, their families, and our local veterans who have served happy holidays. This is Shannon Phillips, Vice President of Operations for the McConnell Foundation. This time of year, Americans are serving our nation in places far from home, as they have every holiday season in our country's history. Let's remember as a community the sacrifices our men and women in uniform have made and will continue to make. The McConnell Foundation salutes our active duty and veterans by wishing you happy holidays.
Slow down. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Reading has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage, and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
You're listening to Chauncey and Kara on Radio Wasteland right here on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. That's Free Fire Radio.
Up next here on Radio Wasteland, where we are showcasing some of our favorite interviews of the past year, is Lawton Anderson describing to us the Dyatlov Pass incident. If you haven't heard of this one, it's very just creepy real, and it's a real incident that happened, and nobody knows why, and, so give it a listen, and let us know what you think.
Find all our shows and archives by visiting Radio Wasteland at radiowasteland.us.
All right, welcome back to Radio Wasteland, and our guest, her pseudonym is Lawton Anderson, that she writes nonfiction under, but her real name, Stacey Galloway, and we're going to talk about the Dyatlov Pass incident. I have to look at the word every time I say it out loud, and she's going to help us understand what that's all about. Stacey, do you have there? Are you there with us?
I am. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh, good, good. You know, normally I start by asking people how they got interested in this, but, we're going to come to that later, because I think a lot of people just maybe don't even know what this is. So can you give us a really basic rundown of what this situation is, and then we'll dig into it a little further.
Sure. This happened in Russia in 1959, during what they call, or what would have been called a winter hike at the time. And, 9 young people ranging in age from 21, actually all in their 20s, except one was 37, went on a winter hike. This entailed, walking in skis, basically. So rather than hiking on foot, they were walking on skis through, the Siberian mountains, and they never came back. So, excuse me, search parties were sent out and found the tent first. The tent itself looked orderly, aside from the fact that it was collapsed, but, you know, from winds or whatever. But after the searchers lifted the tent and, you know, kind of pried it off the frozen ground, there were slashes, knife slashes on the side of the tent. Hmm. And that raised some concern. But the inside of the tent, the shoes were in piles, the clothes were in piles, the money was all there, their passports were all there, but the 9 hikers weren't there. Well, what ended up happening is they started finding their bodies up to a mile away, but not all 9 bodies were together. One was a half mile from the tent, one was 3/4 of a mile. The rest were roughly about a mile, but not all in the same places. One was buried in the snow. 2 were found near the remains of a campfire, but they didn't have their clothes, like their outer clothes on. They were down in, you know, their long johns and stuff like that, all frozen, all dead. The last 4 were found, and that really is what kind of brings the Dyatlov mystery. Not that, I mean, the whole thing is mysterious from, you know, the tent, the condition of the tent. It's collapsed. Things look orderly inside. Nothing's crushed or anything, but there's slashes on the side of the tent. And now we've got the bodies up to about a mile away.
Right.
And those last 4 bodies, 2 of them had crushed ribs. 2 of them were missing their eyes completely, even the skin around their eyes. One of them had a broken neck, and those injuries were I don't even want to say the most unusual, but finding those last 4 bodies kind of, like I said, came into the whole pinnacle of the mystery itself. So now you have 9 very able hikers. They've all been on these long winter hikes before. They've endured different hardships. One had been bitten by a snake during a previous hike and came back and healed up, and she went out again. Another had been accidentally shot by a hunter, and again she healed and came back. The oldest of the group, the 37-year-old, was a World War II veteran. He had survived the war, had all sorts of decorations. And in fact, there's an interesting fact along with that, him, is that only 3% of the men born the year he was born, 1921, that served in World War II, only 3% were still alive. And he was one of those 3%.
At 37.
97% had perished in the war. So it kind of sets the stage for his abilities as well.
Right. Why were they on the winter hike? Is this a government thing or a school thing, or is this like a vacation thing?
Exactly. It was a combination. It was a hike that was sponsored through a university that half of them were still students in the university. The others were alumni, and then the 37-year-old, his name's Simon, he was actually applying to be an instructor there. So the university sponsored the hike, and they provided quite a bit of the supplies, although the students and alumni brought their supplies also. But the government itself at the time, now this is during the Cold War, the government of Russia liked to encourage athleticism And they, you know, kept an eye on that. They were looking for the best athletes and the best either pull them in for their own, you know, the Olympics or for further training, you know, in athleticism or even for maybe military type duties. I mean,
I've seen Rocky IV. I know what they were doing. You know, I said I've seen Rocky IV. I know what they were doing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And
you know,
it's really hard
to get
all
and train all the bad guys.
Yeah. And, you know, that era was just fascinating. I mean, Russia really had a, you know, hand grip on its citizens. It was even these hikes themselves, although coordinated through the university and authorized through the government. The Russian government itself didn't allow citizens to have maps. Now, people could, you know, draw maps. I suppose you could buy maps, you know, on the black market or whatever, but only official military, Russian officials themselves could actually legally own a map. So the saying back then was, if you didn't, well, one, you couldn't have a map, but if you didn't know where you were going, then you weren't supposed to be going there. So these hikes, although, like I said, are sponsored through the university and then encouraged through the government, they didn't, you know, the government didn't take that extra step with, like, okay, here's an official map of the area. A lot of these students would, you know, pass maps back and forth. In fact, it was somebody's job along the hike to kind of sketch and map out where they were.
Sure.
And stuff like that.
So
as far as we know,
they weren't there for any sort of scientific reason. They were just there purely recreationally in athleticism.
It really was. It really was. Now, they belonged to a hiking club at the university itself, and the hiking club had three tiers of hikes that they would allow the students to go on, with a Category 1 being the easiest, a Category 2 being kind of medium, and then Category 3 being this extreme one. Where, now the point of a Category 3, which is what this hike was classified as, one, several of them were qualifying for this Category 3, but several of them had already done these. I'd say it was probably about half. In fact, there were only two. Well, there were two that really weren't up at the Category 3 level yet. They were approved to go. All this had to be run through the university and ultimately the government. They were approved. So the point of the Category 3 hike itself is, one, they're going on skis, you know, so they're basically like ski walking or skiing, you know, across all this terrain. Snow's 12 foot deep. It's January. I mean, it's negative 30 degrees at night. It's just really, really harsh conditions. The other expectation with a Category 3 is no form of communication. They weren't allowed to bring, like, a radio to communicate back and forth. I mean, they were pretty far out there anyway, so there wouldn't have been a lot of people to communicate with. But even, you know, some sort of a radio for emergencies and stuff like that. But the other expectation is they would be carrying all their supplies themselves. There were no sleds. They weren't pulling sleds. This was all the tent, the food, any equipment. Everything was carried in backpacks on their backs.
We don't have too long until a commercial. We got about 2 minutes here until the break. But when we found them, were they lost or were they on the path that we expected them to be on?
I realized
there was about a mile radius that they were either running or separated or whatever. But were they close to where we expected them to be?
The tent itself wasn't on the official course that they had submitted for their itinerary. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of folks that are much more expert at the map thing than, and I'm in awe of the folks that have looked at that, that say that some of the deviations could have come from some landmarks. They could have chosen to go the particular route they went for some reason. So that finding the tent itself took a few days. You know, I mean, airplane searches, kind of looking for tracks. The bodies themselves, it really didn't make sense for where the bodies were. They were in a straight line from the tent, but they were not like back on the trail they had just come from or anything. They were just kind of straight down the slope where the tent was, down the slope, and then up a 15-foot cliff. So they had to climb this cliff, and then the bodies and that was the furthest bodies, those last four. And then from that furthest point all the way back to the tent was almost like a straight line of bodies.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to a North State with no more homeless pets.
Alan Gordon, Coach Master Auto Body. It's been a really devastating year for some of us here in the North State. From the fires in 2018 to Snowmageddon in 2019 and the unprecedented hailstorm, our family and team at Coach Master wish the best for all of you affected by these disasters. We hope that Coach Master was able to ease the stress for our customers that were affected by these events. With the coming of the holiday season, we'd like to thank all of our customers, old and new, for trusting Coachmaster to take care of all of your collision repair needs. Our team would like to wish the community Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And Santa, we don't repair sleighs, so be careful. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Coachmaster Collision Repair continues to be the leader in the North State for advanced technology in the collision repair industry. Remember Coachmaster on East Side Road, serving the Reading community since 1969. Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Hi, I'm Rob Burrows from the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center. Come join me as the new host of brand new Battlefield Expressions show. Battlefield Expressions is a go-to program providing veterans and their families an opportunity to call in and ask questions and receive information particular to their individual needs. Veterans and their families who sacrificed and served our country. Every Saturday, 9 to 11, here at 96.5 FM, 1460 AM Talk Radio.
Aloha, this is Kevin, Operations Manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price, and after a few months, realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big-name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868, 221-5868, MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney of Shasta Gas Propane. Our company motto is, our customers are warm friends. We are demonstrating our commitment to this motto by helping those in our area that lost their homes in the car fire and are moving onto their property in an RV during the rebuilding process. We can hook up a 120-gallon propane tank to your RV gas system and deliver gas to your property so you won't have to disconnect your 7-gallon cylinder and take it somewhere to get it filled, then reconnect it and relight your pilots. We will deliver and connect the tank at no charge, then discount the price of the propane. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793. We want to help you during this stressful time.
You're listening to Free Fire Radio, 96.5 FM, 1460 AM. You're listening to Radio Wasteland with Chauncey and Kara.
Up next here on Radio Wasteland, we have a portion of an interview with Lon Strickler where he tells us the story of his run-in with Mothman. It is it's a great tale, very scary, and worth checking out. You're listening to Radio Wasteland. Blood and murder.
All right, welcome back to Radio Wasteland and our guest, Lon Strickler. We're talking about Mothman here. Lon, in the first segment there, you talked about one of the things that got you interested in this is you had your own experience in sighting, and that definitely piqued my interest. Can you tell me what your experience was?
Well, this happened in the fall of 1988. I had met up with an old friend that I had gone into Boy Scouts with when I was a kid. So we happened to run into each other, and he was actually a scoutmaster then. And he asked me about something that was going on in the old Camp Conowago campground. And he was telling me that a lot of the kids and their troops and such were being run out of the woods near the campground because of these unknown screams. The kids were freaking out. They were packing up and leaving. So he said he and a friend were going up to the campground that next weekend. He asked if I wanted to tag along. So I said, sure. So the next weekend,
and you said,
we met up.
Lon, and you said unknown screams, so you all of a sudden were in? That seems terrifying.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to know what that was.
Yeah, all right.
So,
horror movie character logic.
So we got to the camp, and then we met up and hiked into the woods, and we set up camp along the Conowago Creek. So the first night was pretty uneventful. We each of us had a tent. We had three tents, and though we did hear something walking around in the campsite, though I thought it was probably one of those guys getting up to use a latrine or such, so I didn't really know. But we mentioned it the next morning. So it was a nice day, so we got up and had breakfast and started hiking around the woods and such, and we were out most of the day. Pretty thick woods, too. That time of year is a lot of underbrush. So a lot of wildlife as well. So we got back to the campsite about 6 o'clock in the evening, and we started getting something to eat, sitting around the fire, talking. We were talking about football. And, off and on, I would get up and stretch my legs and walk around. So about 11 o'clock, all of a sudden, this loud scream came from the west, and it was coming in and out. I thought at first it was probably an owl or maybe an eagle, but I didn't know. So it screamed again, and, yeah, this thing sounded like a child screaming. And it had gotten closer, then it kind of faded out again. So we got up and walked around the campsite. We didn't see anything, so we sat back down and started talking some more, trying to figure out what it was that we heard screaming. Well, anyway, I guess around 12:30, 1 o'clock, I got up again to stretch my legs. I walked over by the trail along the creek, and I just had this sense that something was watching us. So I went back to the campfire, and I told those guys, why don't we get up and just walk along the trail a bit, see if we see anything out, So they said, yeah, so we got up and, we didn't walk more than 50 foot away from the campsite. And to the right of us in the creek, and the creek was shallow at this time, and the moonlight was really, really good that night. We saw this being, this whatever, standing in the middle of the creek. It was dark, and it had these red eyes. And by the time we got the flashlights on this thing, it just whooshed up into the air. It jettisoned like a rocket. And a couple seconds later, we heard it screaming and as it flew away from us and, faded out. So I guess we freaked out a bit. We got back to the campsite. My buddy, he didn't want to stay. He wanted to go up the administration building and spend the night.
I don't blame him.
The other guy asked, and the other guy was pretty calm. He said, did you notice anything on his back? Which I did, because it kind of looked like there were folded wings on his back. But, you know, I never saw any wings unfurl. And, you know, I said, yeah, I did notice it. And, of course, we all noticed the red eyes. So they went up, the other two guys went up to the administration building and spent the night up there. I wanted to see what was going on, so I stayed around the campsite. But, you know, nothing else happened that night, so I really didn't get a look at it beyond that. Though, when I wrote about this about 20 years later on my blog, I got a comment from a guy who lived at Dick's Dam, which was upstream from the location. And he was telling me he's heard these screams for years. He never knew what it was. And, not long after that, I guess about a month after, I got another email from a scout leader who told me, he said, you know, we were at Camp Conewaga not long ago, and the boys in my troop came running back one early evening and swore up and down that there was a dragon, a 6-foot-tall dragon, standing in the trail, not far from where we were camped at. And they said it was, you know, looked like it had feathers and a tail, but they said it was a dragon. You know, of course he thought they were nuts, or they were just playing games with him. So he kind of dismissed it. He didn't even bother going up to look, see what was going on. Nothing else had happened the rest the weekend for them. So, but when he saw what I had written, well, then he had second thoughts and said, well, maybe they did see something. So anyway, the last sighting that we have had along the Conewaga Creek that I know of was about 3 years ago. And, from the point along the Conewaga Creek at the campsite, then when it runs along and goes eastbound toward the Susquehanna River, is about a 20-mile stretch. I've had about 5 sightings over the years.
Really?
Reported to me.
Man, that is a lot. So, you know, that kind of prompts my question. Of these 78 sightings that you're referring to in Chicago, you know, how many of those do you think are credible?
That's just the ones I think are credible.
Oh, I see. Oh, wow.
Wow.
That is a lot of sightings.
I mean, there were several that we didn't even bother with. I mean, you know, there weren't many. I tell you, the one thing about these sightings and the reports, and look, we got them from all over the city, all over the region, you know, all races, creeds, everything. I mean, this is, you know, they run the gamut as far as people that made reports. And some people are closer than others. Some had very close encounters. And, people just didn't embellish on the story, which is unusual. You know, normally when you get somebody to call you or send a report in, and then when you talk to them, the second time, you know, that they communicate with is sometimes, most times, there's some type of embellishment, or they say, well, I remember this that I forgot about, or something like that.
I see.
But like this thing left such a great impression on them that even when I tried to prod them to elaborate on their story, they wouldn't do it.
I see.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, that adds to the credibility if they're consistent and,
yeah.
You know,
I mean, how much embellishing do you need to do if you've seen a 7-foot creature with red eyes and wings?
Yeah, like, well, I mean,
you know,
that sticks in your
the
mind.
The sightings themselves, the early sightings were of a Mothman-like being. Then subsequently we got 2 or 3 sightings that were described like an owlman or a lacusa. They were all 6-foot, 7-foot tall.
Hmm.
Some had the red eyes. We had wingspans anywhere from 10 to 12 foot. But I'd say 95% of the sightings since then have been the bat-like or gargoyle-like wings, which really isn't anything indicative of what people saw in Point Pleasant. But the Mothman moniker kind of stuck to people.
Right.
And, you'll see too many winged humanoid sightings around, especially in a major city like Chicago.
Yeah, and it's easy for people to fill in the blanks when they're looking in the dark.
Sure.
All right, you're listening to Lon Strickler. We're coming up on break time. We're talking about Mothman. So, you know, come on back, and we got some more questions for him.
Hi, I'm Sharon Clark of Home Helpers. It's amazing to look back at all the families we've touched since 2004. But our clients say it best.
I want to express my deep appreciation for the love and support you and your...
So fortunate to have an organization like Home Helpers.
You'll never know how much your contribution meant or how greatly you touched our lives.
Thank you so much for helping me care for my husband.
After hearing what it's meant to them, I truly can't imagine doing anything else. When you need help for your loved one, choose Home Helpers. There is no place like home.
Come on, let's sit down together at the Black Bear Diner on Highway 5 in East Cypress and Redding. Stop by for a family-friendly atmosphere, bear-sized portions, and expansive menu. Enjoy breakfast all day with bear-sized portions of their hearty Bigfoot chicken fried steak and eggs, scrumptious bear claw French toast, and signature sweet cream pancakes. Good food, good friends, good times at a place that feels like home. The Black Bear Diner in Redding.
Black Bear feels like home.
Hello, I'm Carlene Niver, and I would like to personally thank you for your support while we celebrate over 4 years of business at Carlene's Restaurant and Bar. I'm so proud and excited to see our growth with loyal and new guests alike. Those of you who know me know that I love great food, but more importantly, I love to enjoy myself wherever I go. And that's what my dining team and I strive for when you walk into Carlene's. As the weather transitions, don't forget to book our banquet room for any of your upcoming holiday needs. We also offer outside catering for any occasion. Open 7 days a week, 4 p.m. to 9 p.m., 10 p.m. Friday and Saturday. Happy hour from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., located in downtown Reading on Center Street. A pinch of patience, a dash of kindness, and a spoonful of laughter make for the best dining experience. I look forward to celebrating over 4 years of business with you at Carlene's Restaurant and Bar.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now you're over. Has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
Radio Wasteland comes to you from the Reading studios of Free Fire Radio, 96.5 FM and AM 1460.
Up next here on Radio Wasteland, we have a portion of an interview with Benjamin Radford, who wrote a book called Bad Clowns. That's not clowns being bad at being clowns, that's malevolent evil clowns. So this was very much a topic that had Kara and I. Written all over it. So check it out. It's a fun one.
All right, welcome back to Radio Wasteland, and our guest, Benjamin Radford, the author of a book called Bad Clowns, which I have to say struck our interest as soon as we saw the title, and I bet you that is the case with a lot of other people. There's a lot of places to enter this topic. Where did you enter?
So I talk about, for example, the history of evil clowns and bad clowns, but specifically the bad ones, because... You know, I was intentionally not covering all clowns. I mean, there's been lots of books and, you know, films, documentaries. I mean, there's lots about clowns, but there's very relatively little about sort of the darker side of clowns. And so that was really what I wanted to focus on. So I go back and you can look at the early clowns, for example, in ancient Greece and the Harlequin. in Harlequin and the evil clowns discussed by, for example, Charles Dickens in one of his novels. And then sort of, so I go chronologically, but then trying to break them down into where do you find these evil clowns, right? And so in some cases, you find them in sensational headlines. For example, you have John Wayne Gacy, of course, the famous killer clown. And then you find them in movies, for example, with Killer Clowns from Outer Space, Pennywise and It, of course, and things like that. And so I tried to sort of break it down into where you find the clowns, again, sort of movies, literature. And then I sort of took a little bit of an odd turn toward the last part of the book, where I included, for example, porn clowns. There's actually there's a category of sex clowns, because of course there is.
Right. Well, balloon animals.
And I looked at troll clowns, sort of the internet troll clowns, and then also what are called dip clowns, which are if you've been on a carnival midway, they're the people that, you know, sit there in the dunk tanks, like, hey there, Freddy, high and dry, high and dry.
Right, right.
And often they're clowns, and so their goal is to insult people and get you angry enough to, you know, put down $5 to buy some balls to hit him in the dunk tank. So that was one of the fascinating parts, where there were so many angles into it. You know, there's Bozo the Clown, Krusty the Clown, all these different ones, and so that's sort of the angle that I took.
You know, so how far back does – so when I was doing a little bit of research for this, you know, the furthest back I could see of really anything – sort of horrific and clowny at the same time was probably Pagliacci or something
yeah.
like that. How far back are we looking at really a tale of the shady clown?
Well, if you're looking at sort of the sketchy clowns, and actually I should clarify that for a minute, because I was trying to figure out, you know, how do I title the book? Because you know, the book is titled Bad Clowns, but it's not people who, you know, are just bad at their job.
Right.
It's all people that are bad at their job. So I had to sort of delineate, okay, what exactly am I talking about? And so it was clowns that are evil or malevolent or not nice in some way. And in some cases, of course, it's fictional, of course, so they're not professional clowns. So, for example, John Wayne Gacy was not a professional clown. You know, the Joker in the DC Comics villain is not a professional clown. So I had to carefully sort of delineate that out. So if you're looking at where did the sort of scary or evil bad clown emerge, you're exactly right. Right around Pagliacci, you can look at the Harlequin figure, which makes his first appearance in 1585. In fact, in poems published in French, and of course the Harlequin is much better known these days, and the Suicide Squad and the more sexy Harlequin. But
yeah, I have to
original,
admit. So I got to
yeah,
tell
there's,
you,
there's
17
story,
years
but...
ago, 17 years ago, I had a daughter. 18 years ago, in about a week, a couple days here. And at the time, Harlequin was this funny cartoon character, nothing else. And so I actually named my daughter Harley Quinn. And so now here I am with a 17-year-old daughter with this, like, super sexified character that's, like, all over, and I have a daughter named Harley Quinn, you know. So I actually
that's
named my daughter.
That's fascinating.
So,
I like that story.
So
no, but basically, the sort of the stereotypically scary clown really emerged again with Harlequin, and then as I mentioned, Dickens wrote about sort of an alcoholic clown, so you have the sort of dual sides. But it's important to keep in mind that the clown figure has always had this darker side to it, and so you can go back to the ancient Greece. For example, there would be European clowns that would sit in town squares and pelt people with nuts or fruits and sort of make fun of their names and say things that are silly.
It's like a game.
And in fact, clown, the word itself, it's of German origin. It's related to the Dutch or German word for boer, as in B-O-E-R, in South Africa, for example. So it's they're a farmer. They're people of the earth. They're everyday, hardworking people like that. So clown meant somebody who was sort of rustic or ill-mannered or sort of rough around the edges. And so that was always part of the character anyway. And so it wasn't really until the 1980s when you saw the scary clowns sort of, you know, pop into the cultural consciousness with you know, Stephen King's It and Pennywise and things like that. But the clown figure has always been ambiguous. It's always had this darker side to it, and that's what Stephen King played against. Was this American notion that, oh, clowns are happy, they're good, they're, you know, they make you laugh, they do balloon animals. Well, that's one version of the clown, but if you look at European clowns and really the history of clowns, clowns have never, they were never really good. They were just, sometimes they were good, sometimes they were bad, sometimes they were making you laugh, sometimes they were scaring the hell out of you. So there's always been that darker side to it.
There seemed to be a transition, at least in American culture, where clowns became much more nefarious in the views of the regular person. And I'm wondering if in your book you stumbled across maybe why that happened. My thoughts were maybe, you know, Stranger Danger. Kara here was thinking that Stephen King's It is really what pushed it over. You know, what do you think?
I think you're all right. there's a couple different things that happened.
Very diplomatic.
Yeah, thank you. I just pulled that one out of my butt. it's interesting because and that was one of the really when I was writing the book at first I was like, well, what am I going to write about? It's like there's just these clowns but then really when I began peeling back the layers and tracing back, you know, how the influences go, that's where the book really got interesting to me was sort of tracing back. Oh, this is where this happened. So, for example, you know. The Joker, the DC Comics villain. I mean, the Joker was introduced in 1940.
Right.
That's the it's not like the American public had never heard of evil clowns. And of course, he was portrayed, you know, by Cesar Romero. That Joker wasn't terribly scary.
Right.
In the Batman series, but really, there was always there's always there, but it wasn't really, it didn't really explode again until as you mentioned the 1980s. So there's a couple of things. One thing that happened was Stephen King's It. As you mentioned, but it wasn't so much the book. The book itself was scary and it was a bestseller and all that, but it wasn't really until 1990 when it was a TV movie. It was a two-part TV movie, and I think we're all about the same age, so we probably remember what that was.
Oh, I definitely saw it. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was really what made the difference. And so, keep in mind that, you know, there's the recent remake of It, and part one came out last year, and part two is supposed to come out later this year. But part of the reason that Pennywise and It became such a hugely popular character was because it wasn't, for example, a PG or R-rated film in the theaters you had to go pay money to see. It was on national television. It was being broadcast into people's homes across the country. And you had Tim Curry with this manic, terrifying thing. And that became like, oh my God, you remember seeing that? So, you know, had that film, instead been put in theaters, it's likely that Pennywise wouldn't be nearly as popular because it just wouldn't have been seen by that many people.
Thank you. The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.